AI and climate change. Hello, and welcome to this 39 Essex Chambers AI and Climate Change podcast. This is a collaboration episode between the 39 Essex Chambers AI and the Law podcast series and the Climate Law Matters podcast series. I'm Catherine Apps KC, and today I'm joined by Stephen Tromans KC. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Catherine. Nice to be with you.
In this episode, we're going to be discussing similarities, differences, and areas of overlap between these two developing legal areas, which have very much captured the public imagination. For regular listeners of the Climate Law Matters podcast, Stephen's not going to need any introduction. But for new listeners, and particularly those of the AI and Law series, Stephen has been at the forefront of developing the law on climate change from the very earliest stages. Stephen started off his legal life as an academic at Cambridge University. Then he became a solicitor at Simmons & Simmons in 1990, where he set up and ran one of the very first environmental law practices in the UK. He then moved over to the bar in 1999 and joined 39 Essex Chambers. Areas that Stephen covers in his practice include particularly nuclear law, which we're going to be discussing in this podcast, renewable energy, environmental assessment, biodiversity, habitats, contaminated land, industrial emissions, and major infrastructure projects. Thank you so much for speaking with me today, Stephen.
Delighted to be here.
Now, in the AI and Law podcast series, we've been exploring a number of themes across the episodes, including how law can most appropriately regulate at the same time as the pace of emerging technological developments being rapid, and where potential risks posed by the new technology are both serious and diffuse. Now, in some ways, it feels as though there might be some parallels across to the emergence of environmental law. Do you think there are any parallels?
Yes, Catherine, I think there are actually some strong parallels. So, in particular, a lot of the environmental problems we face now stem from allowing substances, materials, to be emitted into the environment without any clear understanding of what their potential effects might turn out to be. And so one can see how those effects in some cases have been permanent and even irreversible. So we think of microplastics in the environment, chlorofluorinated compounds, the so-called forever chemicals, which we find everywhere these days, and of course, greenhouse gases. Now, there were no doubt very strong commercial reasons and drivers behind all of those technologies, and no doubt they benefited people as technological advances, just as will be claimed for AI. But those benefiting from the advances are not necessarily the same people that will bear the harmful externalities from them, potentially far into the future. And so I see in some ways the emission of AI into the cyber environment without a very clear understanding of its possible effects and measures to control its risks as being absolutely no different to that, which means that, as I know we'll be discussing, strong regulation is going to be necessary. I would just add that, of course, AI isn't without its own direct environmental effects. So the data centres which are necessary for the expansion of AI will have huge demands in terms of water and electricity for cooling. We already see that. Those demands are going to get much greater. And it's notable that some of the leaders in the field, such as Apple, are looking at the creation of bespoke nuclear power plants to provide the reliable energy baseload needed. So I think one can't just say that the effects of AI are cyber effects. They are actually potentially real physical effects as well.
Well, that's really interesting. We'll be touching on nuclear law a little bit later in the podcast, but that's a direct intersection of the two areas. As you just discussed, the potential risks and the effects of emerging technology, particularly in a time of rapid industrial advance, is very difficult to predict and also inherently international. Would you say that it's inevitable in the AI context, in terms of this strong regulation that you referred to, that there would need to be a system of domestic regulation underpinned by statute and a domestic regulator, then rules at the level of countries in a particular area, for instance, the EU, and also multilateral international treaties. Would you say that's inevitable in the AI context, or is there a different way of going about it?
I think so, that it is inevitable. There are, again, quite obvious parallels with the environmental world. So we know that some pollutants, physical pollutants, are highly mobile. It doesn't matter one jot in which country you release them. Greenhouse gases are the paradigm for that. And so you can have the strictest national laws you like, but unless there is an effective international system of cooperation, attempts to curb those emissions is going to be doomed to failure. Now, some of this in the environmental world depends on whether there is an available, commercially acceptable solution. And so for CFCs, chlorofluorocarbons, the Montreal Protocol many years ago was successful in protecting the ozone layer, which was under threat, because commercial alternatives to those chemicals came on the market at the right time. With greenhouse gas, the situation is much more complex and intractable. And I suspect AI probably partakes more of the greenhouse gas scenario than the CFC scenario in terms of its difficulty. So the issue arises really as to what form of international cooperation is needed. And I think we can see there are various parallels and possible models for this. So there could be, for example, a research-based model. An example of that is CERN, the European Centre for Nuclear Research, which dates back to 1952 for collaboration in research on nuclear matters. Another example is standard setting. A good example of that is the International Civil Aviation Authority, or organisation, set up in 1944 to regulate airlines. Of course, big international dimension to that. And thirdly, an inspection and enforcement body, such as we have in the nuclear field with the International Atomic Energy Agency. Now, all of those responded in different ways to clearly perceived advances in technology which were going on, and the problems, even potentially existential problems, that those technologies could be seen as posing. And I think which model one prefers maybe tends to reflect your interests. So we know that Microsoft likes the ICAO model. Researchers like the CERN model, a research-based model. OpenAI, I've read, has been reported as calling for an IAEA for superintelligence. So I think probably we need all three of those functions, actually, to cope with AI. It's not one or the other. I think all three are needed. And we are now starting to see, as you'll know, the beginnings of international cooperation in terms of the EU AI Act, the recent bilateral agreement between the US and the UK, and also the work of the Council of Europe Committee on Artificial Intelligence, focusing in particular on human rights implications. So all coming at it from somewhat different angles. What I think is clear is that the effort has to be international. National law maybe could address simpler AI applications and language learning models, but when we get into the area of frontier AI, the really advanced stuff, which we know very little about and know even less about the risks of at present, then I think it's got to be an international effort.
Yeah, I think that is very much reflecting a lot of the discussions in the AI world at the moment. I think perhaps what's particularly interesting is I'm not sure that it's necessarily being reported so widely that there are those very different models, particularly as you've seen in the environmental context, of dealing with particular different types of risks or particular different types of uses. And as you say, AI is so broad, we'll probably need a combination of all of those. Turning our focus now a bit more domestically, how much has the common law been able to provide solutions within the field of environmental law?
Well, if we're looking particularly at things like greenhouse gas emissions, where the impact is somewhat indirect and causation and so on is difficult, then the common law at present has only been effective to a limited extent for the same reasons I think that would apply in AI. So difficulties in proving causation in terms of the harm suffered, the attribution of harm, who do you sue, identifying the correct defendant, questions of forum, which national courts do you sue in? And of course, related to that, how then do you enforce judgments? So I think it will be difficult in AI, just it's been difficult and it's proving difficult in the environmental area. But one can see how there could be the potential in future for massive class action claims against those developing and deploying AI if it goes wrong, which I guess must be a worry to them. And I've got little doubt that when things do go wrong and third-party harm does occur, there'll be no shortage of law firms lining up to represent potential claimants.
Would it be fair to say that in the environmental world, the common law has had more impact where there's provable harm that can already be shown, presumably because that completes the tort, whereas other litigation has been focused on the specific statutory duties that lie at an earlier stage? And there's been a combination of, would you say, regulatory actions against perpetrators and then forays into judicial review and otherwise as to the scope of those duties as they apply to individual actors or public authorities having regard to them?
Yes, I would say where you have direct provable harm. So, for example, the claims made against Shell in relation to oil pollution from their pipelines in Nigeria, that's just bread and butter stuff, really, in a way, for the common law, although obviously there are difficulties on class actions, jurisdiction, and so on. But when you get into someone who is trying to prove that they've been harmed by the emission of greenhouse gases, that at present, I think, is really, in England anyway, very problematic. So the focus has tended to be on trying to enforce duties against the state through judicial review, which, of course, is difficult in its own right because the grounds of judicial review, as we know, are pretty narrow when it comes down to it.
Well, exactly. And you have to fall back on establishing a positive obligation of the state to regulate another third party. And I suppose so far we haven't seen a huge amount of success domestically, environmentally, in that type of litigation, usually brought by reference to the Human Rights Act. But just to show how topical we are, just yesterday, on the 9th of April 2024, the European Court of Human Rights gave judgment in the Swiss greenhouse gas case, didn't it? I don't know, does that change your view as to how human rights potentially can form a basis for domestic litigation in the environmental sphere? Or am I bouncing you into that question rather too soon after the judgment?
No, that's fine. I'm happy to respond. Obviously, I think that's seen as a big landmark for climate change lawyers. I think the implications of it are going to have to be worked out, not only in Switzerland, but in other countries which are parties to the Human Rights Convention. And obviously, one of the issues is the victim status. As I understand it, the association of the ladies in Switzerland were victims, whereas other claimants, younger, were not necessarily victims. But I think it presents a lot of food for thought in AI, in the sense that the science with climate change shows that the state failing to regulate is going to have effects which can be predicted to a degree on the citizens. And one could say, although, again, I suspect the science on this is emerging, that risks, predictable or unpredictable, citizens are going to flow from the dissemination of AI within a jurisdiction if it's not adequately regulated. Now, less clear than climate change what those consequences might be, but one can see how there could be, if AI goes wrong, people who fall into the classes of victim in relation to it in terms of their human rights.
Exactly, and there are people who wouldn't be necessarily be victims of tort for the purposes of the common law, because they're people who are exposed to a greater risk, but they haven't actually already suffered tortious harm. And there's a really interesting discussion in that case about European Convention on Human Rights law on the victim status, as you say, and who that protects and how that's arguably a lot broader than the law currently domestically in the UK. Turning our focus now from European human rights law to EU law. Obviously, the UK is no longer a member of the EU following Brexit, but the EU has regulated AI somewhat more muscularly than many other groups of countries or the UK. And there's a new EU AI Act, which has recently come out, which is a legislative act which requires regulation by reference to the level of class of risk posed by the particular technology. Is this mirrored at all in environmental law? And if so, how? Are there particular examples?
Yes, very much so. And from what I've seen of the EU AI Act, I applaud the muscularity, as you put it, of its approach. It looks very much like what is needed, which is a risk-based approach. That's, of course, a very familiar approach in EU and other environmental law. Underpins a lot of areas such as technical standards, chemicals regulation, controls over pesticides, nuclear, assessment of major projects, to name but a few. The onus needs to be on the developer, whether it be of these chemicals or high-risk AI, to assess the risks and to demonstrate they're acceptable. There should be an onus, it seems to me, on the developer to have carried out a complete assessment of risks to be able to demonstrate that those risks are acceptable. And the precautionary principle, which is long established in EU law, which is that uncertainty is a reason to restrict rather than a reason not to regulate, holds equally good, in my view, to AI. And post-Brexit, I can see that, as with chemicals, the UK is going to need to develop its own system along the EU lines, and that divergences between the two systems, as in chemicals, for instance, will be very problematic for the industry concerned. So it'd be best, probably, if there were a comprehensive international treaty which both the UK and the EU could accede to. And I think one other parallel, just on this point, in relation to European regulation, comes from the evolving and the self-learning nature of AI, particularly these more complex frontier models. If AI systems can interact and learn from each other, which I think my understanding is the case, at least in prospect they can, then they may be highly unpredictable, cumulative or synergistic effects, which could be very difficult to control, just as can happen in the environment where one chemical released reacts with another or changes over time. But obviously much more complex potentially in the AI field.
That's a really interesting thought, because I'd thought of that as being a particular challenge with AI in relation to the question that you asked earlier about who is the right defendant in any environmental cause of action. Is it the developer? Is it the user? Is it the state for failing to control the user or the distributor? But what we have with AI is the system is able to actually change itself. But as far as I'm aware, certainly in the UK, an AI system doesn't have its own legal personality. People have legal personality, companies have legal personality, and in certain circumstances, companies can be liable for, you know, their employees, their agents, and sometimes their contractors. But what is being created now is a new semi-autonomous being that doesn't have any personality at all. But from listening to you, in some ways, it's not massively different from a chemical that, once released due to its chemical properties, may react in either predictable or unpredictable ways with things that it meets in the environment around it. So maybe it isn't quite as new as all that particular question.
It's not nothing new under the sun, is there? I don't think it's entirely new, but I think it's very difficult and very complicated in the AI field.
Yes, indeed. And in the chemicals example, does liability rest with the original creator or with the distributor or sometimes both? Is there a solution to that problem of the chemical once released having unpredictable consequences?
Well, if we take, for instance, the way the UK has adopted its rules on contaminated land, which are statutory, a deliberate choice was made there to say that the polluter, i.e. the person who released the chemical, is liable for changes to that chemical. If that chemical changes, transforms itself in some way into something different, which causes harm, then they are liable for that just as much as for the original chemical. But obviously there can be great difficulties where you've got two different people releasing things which interact. That's quite tricky. And I can see how that could happen in the AI field. Certainly, couldn't it? Two models talk to each other,
yep,
and come up with something unpleasant. So I think the attribution of harm is going to be a real issue to be addressed in the AI field.
That's really interesting. I said we'd return to the nuclear example, and I know you've done a huge amount of work over the years in the nuclear world. And in some ways, some of the risks posed by nuclear are, you know, at the existential level, a bit like they are with climate change more generally and possibly with AI. Are there any lessons that you can learn from your experience in nuclear law specifically that might be applicable to the AI world?
Very much so, I would say. The parallels are, of course, with nuclear and AI, that both technologies have great potential for the good for society in creating cheap, reliable energy in the case of nuclear, and also medical uses, etc. But also the real possibility of either malevolent, negligent use, which could have very widespread and irreversible effects in the case of a nuclear accident or terrorists gaining access to nuclear material and using it for some sort of incident. So when the civil nuclear industry was being developed in the post-World War II world, everyone from World War II was acutely aware of the destructive potential of atomic materials, and there was no established safety record to guide insurance underwriters when civil nuclear plants were being developed. So the US, the UK, numerous other countries decided they would enact domestic legislation imposing a liability regime. Interestingly, those domestic piece of legislation later fed through into international law, which we discussed earlier in the context of AI. So the features of the laws which were enacted generally, which I think may be in principle equally apposite to AI, although I'd accept they may be very difficult to work out in practice, were first of all a system of strict liability, no fault liability, so no argument as to negligence or anything like that if harm occurs. Secondly, the channeling of liability to a single legal person. So in the case of a nuclear plant, if it blew up, then it was the operator who was on the hook. They couldn't argue it was really the person who designed it or built components of it, etc. Thirdly, liability was capped to a particular level which was insurable, and there was compulsory insurance required. There were time limits on claims, again, to make it insurable. And there were clear rules as to the exclusive forum in which claims were to be made. Now, all of those seem to me, in principle, issues which should be thought about in relation to AI. So, yes, I think there are things to be learned.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I suppose the one potential difference is that, I suppose, in nuclear, there are also hard-edged prohibitions on the trading of nuclear materials, which makes your market very small, whereas the market is potentially very large in the AI field, and you see very large economic actors trying to, or it's being said that they're trying to sort of solidify their position within that market, you know, where they already have dominance in certain other software markets, which I suppose you didn't have that in nuclear because there wasn't that market already there and you couldn't trade into it. So maybe a little bit more is needed on top of the regulation from that.
Well, actually, I mean, there always has been a trade in nuclear materials. So the supply of enriched uranium, supply of nuclear fuel, supply of components for nuclear reactors, I mean, those are all international markets. The state has no monopoly over those. But what there is are very strict rules, designed safeguards rules, so that those technologies don't fall into the wrong hands. And I think that's one of the, we may come onto this, one of the things that concerns me about AI is it getting into the wrong hands of people who might wish to use it in ways it was perhaps not intended for, or which are not particularly beneficial to society.
Yeah, that's interesting. I suppose it's one of the things that's often said about regulation of social media, that one of the great risks there is that it's very powerful for those who have a very clear aim as to what they want to achieve, and particularly if that aim is not helpful to society, for instance, swinging an election or pushing self-harm videos towards teenagers and that kind of thing. The processing power and the access power of this technology can be truly remarkable. And if there isn't any bar on any of those transactions that are getting up and running, then you have something potentially very dangerous indeed.
Well, I think maybe one can learn, again, a few lessons from the nuclear industry on this. I mean, I would comment that in the IT social media field, obviously the big players seem to be very reluctant to contemplate being regulated as opposed to their own self-regulation. But I really feel that with AI, regulation is needed. And I think if we look at nuclear, one of the issues there is justification. So it's an commonly accepted international practice that if you are carrying out a practice which involves radiation, ionizing radiation, whether it be power producing, research, medical, security, whatever it might be, then that practice has to be formally justified by assessing what the risks of the activity are in terms of radiological exposure, and the regulators satisfying themselves that those risks are clearly outweighed by the benefits from the practice. So I would want to put those producing AI on the spot and say, look, actually, what are the benefits of your practice which are justifying the risks, and how can you actually ensure that the practice is clearly defined and doesn't spill over into lots of other less desirable practices. Now, that may be very difficult, but I think it has to be thought through. Secondly, we've mentioned security and safeguards. So how do those producing AI, what responsibilities do they have for preventing that AI falling into, if I put it this way, the wrong hands? And also in nuclear, as I mentioned, compulsory insurance. Now, interesting to contemplate, if one had a system whereby those producing AI had, as nuclear operators do, to have in place some insurance or other form of financial security to cover the potential losses which might occur from accidents or harm resulting from their technology, I'd be very interested to see how they would approach that and what the attitude of insurers would be. But again, it seems to me one shouldn't be letting people produce anything which creates a great risk to society on the polluter pays principle without them having the wherewithal to satisfy any claims made against them.
I do find this fascinating. In other episodes of this series, we've talked about, we've called it legal toolmaking, that, as you say, in some ways, nothing is actually that new under the sun. And there's a lot of experience from very diverse areas as to particular legal tools that have in the past and can be very suitable and effective at dealing with very particular issues. And you just raised three that I don't think are part of the mainstream discourse in the AI world, coming directly from nuclear law. Can I ask you this one question about nuclear law, though? Knowing what you know now about how things have gone, are there any wrong turns that the law made in terms of nuclear law that you would caution against repetition in the AI sphere from what you know now?
Yes, again, I think there are parallels, strong parallels, actually. Most of the mistakes in the nuclear field were made in the 1950s through to the 1970s, I would say, when countries were rushing into nuclear technology, both for military purposes and also for power production. And that led to some very lax practices being allowed because the commercial wish to get these technologies up and running dictated that future issues in terms of the costs of dealing with waste products and spent fuel, etc., were not adequately considered. So those externalities were not thought through. We're now paying a very big price for that in the UK and elsewhere, running into billions of pounds in terms of the cleanup required because of failure to think through those risks and their long-term consequences. And certainly in the nuclear field, we've got new types of reactors now coming in, small modular reactors, advanced nuclear technologies. And exactly the same point applies. Those developing these technologies just want to get them to market and get them funded and earn money. They're not particularly concerned about the long-term problems unless they're made to be. And the same, I think, is true of AI. People just want to get the funding in. Talking about the problems doesn't help to get the funding, but I think society does need to talk about the problems. And that I think, is the big lesson I would take away from nuclear.
Oh, interesting. So I suppose if you're a software developer, you don't make money out of the development because that's very expensive. You only make money once it starts getting out to market and people start buying it, and being first on the market has enormous advantages from that perspective. But as you say, if we as a society don't think carefully about what it is that's coming out onto the market, then there can be some very expensive things down the line that take a huge amount of time, money, and potentially irreversible harm to sort out later. Can I ask you a question, which we've actually asked all of our guests on the AI and Law podcast? And this is about how optimistic or pessimistic you are about the role of AI in the future. And on this scale, 0 is the most pessimistic you could be, and 10 is the most optimistic that it's going to cure absolutely everything. Where would you place yourself on the scale?
I, of course, can see the potential benefits of AI. And I think, for instance, in the environmental field, one can see possible benefits through its use in conjunction maybe with other technologies such as satellite imagery and so on enforcement, identification of environmental problems, etc. So I don't in any way discount those possible benefits. But I'm afraid I'm not, at the moment, optimistic, because I think there is the very strong potential for AI to be exploited in ways which are not to the benefit of society. And at the moment, I don't see any effective means of controlling or preventing that. And I'm also concerned that many of its uses, even if they're not malevolent uses, will be essentially trivial entertainment-related uses, if I can put it that way, and of little real benefit to society relative to the risks that's being created. So I'm afraid at present, I'm going to put my optimism at zero.
Oh, wow.
But I hope I'm not proved wrong.
Oh, goodness. Well, we've had, I think, pretty much every number on this podcast series, apart from you are our very first zero. We've had nines, we've had quite a lot of fives, sixes, had some threes and ones in between. But it's not saying that it's wrong at all.
No. Well, I'm glad to be a hero for zero.
Well, a hero for zero. And I think it just sort of shows how important it is to talk about all this, that there is that what really wide spectrum across people from all different sort of legal backgrounds.
If you've acted as I have really in the field of regulation and seen so many things over the 30, 40 years I've been working in environment that have gone wrong, it doesn't fill me with optimism. But I'm very happy to be proved wrong on this. Maybe come back in a couple of years and it'll all be fine. Systems will be in place.
I think you're right. You're the only guest that we've had who's very much lived in a very deeply in a very parallel world to this and has seen so much of regulation go wrong as well as right in an area that has, you know, such potential sort of cross-border and existential consequences. That said, the world hasn't ended quite yet, so hopefully there is some cause for optimism. And on that note, I'm going to say thank you so much to Stephen Tromans for joining me today, and thank you for joining us for what's been a fascinating discussion. I'm Catherine Apps with Stephen Tromans, and you have been listening to the AI and Law podcast series with 39 Essex Chambers in collaboration with the Climate Law Matters podcast. For further episodes on both series, please go to 39essex.com, and the podcasts are also available from all major podcast streaming services. There's also a new 39 Essex podcast series launching very soon with Victoria Hutton at 39 Essex Chambers, and that's going to be Hot Topics in Planning and Environmental Law. And I know that one of her very first guests is actually going to be Stephen Tromans, and that will also be available through the same pages and platforms. So watch out for that podcast shortly. Also, if there are any other topics you'd find interesting for further episodes, please do contact us through the 39 Essex Chambers website. Thank you for listening.